Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls. Advertisers in some of the 20th century, at least the second half of the 20th century, seem to have no problem targeting African-American consumers. But for much of that century, the advertising industry was closed to African-Americans. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about how the battle for inclusion waged by Black advertising professionals, and also explore how their involvement in the industry helped promote positive images of Black life in the United States. Our guest for the program is Jason Chambers. He is assistant professor of advertising here at the University of Illinois and has authored a book that is titled Madison Avenue and the Color Line, African Americans in the Advertising Industry. It's published by the University of Pennsylvania Press, fairly recently out, and explores this area, and we'll talk with him this morning in this part of the show. Questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, people who are listening have questions, they can call. The only thing we ask is that people just are brief so that we can keep moving along, but anybody's welcome to call. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, David.
Something that I guess is striking that actually is slightly contrary to what I just said here that comes across in the book is that it seemed that it took some time for corporate America to wake up to the fact that there was an African-American market, that there were significant numbers of African-American consumers and that they had money to spend. And perhaps if you approach them in the right way with the right sort of message, you could persuade them to buy your product. Seeing that for a long time, it was a market they completely ignored, or perhaps it was that they were underestimating and undervaluing that market.
Well, I think you're talking about a combination of factors there, David. I think you're talking about, as I discuss in the book, the concept of racism trumping capitalism, the very worries. A, certainly is the worries that if we start targeting African-American consumers, what will that then mean to our white consumer base? But also the very lack of awareness of the existence of an African-American consumer market with these large dollars to spend, with an interest in spending them, if you actually targeted them appropriately and if you actually targeted them with respect. And that's mm-hmm. something that took the better part of probably 6+ decades to get American corporations to recognize in significant number.
Yeah. So was it the fact that they just somehow thought that African Americans didn't have enough discretionary income to bother with? You would think that they would think, well, Black Americans, they buy the same stuff that everybody else has to buy. They're going to buy toothpaste and washing powder, and why not market your product to them?
Well, and that becomes the very question. And what a lot of times, because the first group of persons to really get into trying to push American corporations to market their products to African-American consumers were African-American media owners, newspaper leaders, because simply put, if you're in a for-profit media, you recognize that the bulk of your dollars may come from advertising revenue. And so African-American editors and publishers looked at their pages and said, we could put out a lot better newspapers. We could put together a lot more pages, a lot more stories if we had greater advertising revenue. So if I'm the owner of, let's just say, the New York Age, which was an African-American-focused newspaper in New York City, I can look at the New York Times and I can see they have a lot of pages. They have a lot of advertising revenue. I'd like to do something similar. And so if they were going to do that, they had to attract these corporations and specifically their advertising agencies to their pages. And that's where the problem started to come in, was educating either the advertising agency or educating the actual advertiser. So let's just say a Procter & Gamble or a Pepsi Cola, educating them to the existence of this market with these dollars to spend.
Yeah. Something else that you touched on, I think, is also interesting as well, is that white corporate America somehow had this idea that if white consumers knew that the corporations were really trying to reach out to Black consumers, we're making a deliberate sort of effort to market to Black consumers, that somehow the white consumers would be offended by this.
That's exactly right. And it's curiously, it's a problem that exists even in our own time. You still have corporations having those worries that if our product gets labeled as a Black product or an urban product, we might say today. What does that then mean to our white consumers? How does that impact our brand image? And for most of the century, even up to our own present time, many corporations answer that question and say, our perception is that it would impact our product and our brand image negatively. Or as one advertiser said, or as many advertising agencies may have said at the time when asked if we're talking about the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, as they're talking to these African-American newspaper leaders and other representatives, other media representatives who are asking for advertising revenue or advertising contracts, well, they would mollify them by saying, well, I'm not racist or I'm not bigoted, but my customers, they're not as enlightened as I am. And so therefore, rather than risk offending my customers, we're going to avoid this market entirely.
Mm-hmm. And is it still problematic? Another thing I think is really striking, if you look at generally, if you look at the subject of images of African Americans appearing in advertising, mm-hmm. it seems that you see, if you go back far enough, what you're going to see is obviously grossly offensive racial stereotypes. And then perhaps you'll get to a period where actually you don't see African Americans at all. You maybe you mostly got rid of that stuff, that first bunch of stuff, but then African Americans just sort of disappeared. And then there would be a period where there was more of an effort to, in the people that you show in your advertising, mm-hmm. to make it look like America looks. And not only so, you have all kinds of Americans, you have disabled people, you try to show the range. But having said that maybe we're at this point now where the images, there's this effort to make the images more inclusive. Is that still, though, problematic, this issue of who it is you put into your ads?
It's still problematic, maybe not from the perception or from the position, I should say, of numbers in terms of the actual inclusion. If we look at advertisements today and the range of actual images that are in them, you can make the argument today that you do see a number of diverse persons, whether that's diversity in terms of age, diversity in terms of disability to some extent, diversity in terms of sexual orientation, or certainly based upon race. But I think where people would make the argument is that all we're simply doing there is a rainbow version of advertising. It's a very basic version of advertising that doesn't take into account different nuances in terms of culture, different nuances in terms of language that persons in those subgroups or subcategories that they would and how they would like to see themselves represented in terms of their lifestyle and their choices and the way that their families look or behave. And so we're certainly seeing differences in terms of number and in terms of the range of products and in terms of the roles that people of diverse backgrounds play in advertisements that just in the course of the research that I've done over the last 5 to 7 years, there's been certainly been a change, maybe more change than we'd seen in the previous 60 years. You can mm-hmm. make the argument in terms of that, but in terms of the cultural usages and the like, not so much.
Yeah. It's quite clear, apparently, it has been the case in the African-American community for a long, long time, going back that people were very sensitive about the images of African-Americans that appeared in advertising, and that people didn't, going back, certainly going back before World War II, people did not like, that African-Americans didn't like a lot of the stuff that they saw, and that actually would influence their consumer decisions. But that was something that, amazingly enough, white corporate America seemed completely insensitive to. The idea that a particular kind of image to a potential African American consumer would be offensive, and they'd say, "Well, I'm not going to have anything to do with that product." That seemed to be to get that idea across to corporate America seemed sort of revolutionary. That mm-hmm. that they should even think about such a thing, or that someone like one of the people that you profile in the book actually tried to work as a consultant to say, look, I'm going to give you a list of stuff.
That's right.
Don't do this.
Right.
That you should have to say, don't do this is sort of stunning. And that was what it was in the 40s?
That's exactly right. You're talking there about a gentleman by the name of David Sullivan, who was an advertising consultant as well as advertising agency owner and executive for many years. And he put out a list in the early 1940s of do's and don'ts to reach the Negro, as they would have said at the time, do's and don'ts to reach the Negro consumers. Things like don't name Negro men George. And the reason why he said that, it might have appeared relatively innocuous to a casual observer, but the reason why he made that point was that on trains, which were the mass transportation at the time, trains which largely featured Negro porters, people wouldn't learn the porters' names, and so they would call them all George. Well, their name may have been Tom, it may have been Harry, it may have been Richard, it may have been Sebastian, for all I know, but the customers wouldn't learn the porters' names, and so they would call them all George. And so rather than have a sense of individuality, there was a sense of, well, they're all the same. And so Sullivan said, that's offensive to many in the Negro consumer market, and so don't do something as simple as what would seem as simple as that to you is actually a very complex and problematic thing to this consumer group. And so it's a matter of what Sullivan is saying. It's a matter of knowing your consumer. It's a matter of knowing the things that he or she is sensitive to and avoiding those things. But again, you're talking about a list that would seem not to be necessary, but at the time was very much necessary.
Yeah. Well, even before 1930, there were apparently people who were looking at attitudes of African-Americans toward images of black people in advertising and knew that that was problematic. But here, still as late as the 40s, somebody was still having to come along and said, look, these things that you're doing, don't. If you want to sell to African Americans, don't do this.
That's exactly right. And you could see maybe not public lists like that, but arguments that were very similar to that as far forward as the 1980s. It becomes, hey, don't do this if you want to reach black consumers. Don't do this if you want to reach black consumers. Or these kinds of things offend black consumers. And again, this is a very active consumer market that votes with their dollars. And if they become offended, if the problem becomes known widely enough, you're going to lose business. And not only will you lose business amongst the African-American consumer, but you'll lose business in amongst your broader consumer base as well. And that's the language that any business owner can understand. The loss of revenue will lead to necessary changes in many cases.
Yeah. Just to introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, we're talking with Jason Chambers. He teaches advertising here at the University of Illinois. He's also an advertising consultant. He is the author of the book Madison Avenue and the Color Line. It takes a look at the participation of African Americans in the advertising industry, and it is published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Certainly, there in the period we're talking about, say, before World War II, there must have been black businesses, black-owned businesses, who were wanting to sell to black consumers. How did they approach marketing to this segment of the population?
Well, what they did was they were very active in terms of researching their consumer populations and finding out the things that their consumer populations liked, the things that they disliked, the things that worked in their advertising, the things that did not work in their advertising. So they were primarily talking about things like black-owned insurance companies or black-owned cosmetics or hair preparation firms. And so they were very forward in terms of actually changing their advertisements when necessary and making alterations when necessary. And so they were some of the early forerunners to doing significant research into this consumer market and making adjustments and changes when and where necessary. Mm-hmm. And so they reached out to, in many cases, they had their own in-house advertising firms, or they reached out to some of the small African-American-owned advertising firms that existed in the major cities like New York and Chicago primarily.
And there were black-owned advertising firms. They were not like the very big firms, but they did exist in the 30s and the 40s. Even at that time, there were.
Certainly, even as early as the 19-teens, there were small African-American-owned advertising firms that were like the vestiges of the early, we can call it, if we separate it out into general market advertising firms or mainstream advertising firms, we can use that phrase as well, or black-owned advertising firms. Their structures were similar. Their capabilities were similar in that early period. It's the difference was primarily in their size. But African-American-owned firms could do advertising creation from the very inception of it, the creation of the advertisement, all the way through its placement in some cases.
Mm. Maybe you could talk some more about black media and how it not only how it helped to reinforce or define the idea that there actually was a significant market here, that the African-American population constituted a significant market, and that they had money to spend, and that if you tailored your message in the right way, you could sell to them. How growth of black media, first, I suppose, would be newspapers, but then probably the really big development was the appearance of Ebony.
Correct.
Magazine. How that helped to, in a sense, define the market and then also then persuade corporate America that this market existed and it was something that they needed to pay attention to.
It really is an interesting transition because it's a story that really starts with African American owned media and Africa, specifically African American newspapers. As I referenced earlier in the interview, or in our discussion, I should say, it was African American newspaper owners who first and foremost said, if nothing else, this is a potential source of revenue that we wish to tap into, these advertising dollars. And so it's those editors and those publishers who are going to businesses and their advertising agencies and saying, hey, give us advertising contracts and allow us to have access to that revenue. The challenge was, and this was what African-American newspaper representatives and consultants said to these African-American newspaper owners, the challenge was that the African-American newspaper side of media is one whose tradition was founded largely in protest. And so largely doing things like exposing issues of discrimination, editorializing on discrimination and racism and challenges in the workplace. And so the challenge became, how do we sell ourselves as a source of advertising to a company that maybe we've blasted on the front page for their discrimination in employment? So how do I get an advertisement on page 5 if on page 3 I editorialized about how you're not hiring African-American workers, white collar or blue collar? And so the African-American press, for many reasons, had challenges acquiring those advertising contracts for many years. And so it's only when we get the appearance of Ebony magazine after World War II, that you have a source that's not necessarily founded in protest, although Ebony did have articles like that, but it's a magazine that is just a general interest magazine along the lines of a Life magazine or along the lines of a Saturday Evening Post, a pictorial magazine that just has general interest stories, sports, entertainment, celebrity life. And that becomes a source that is similar enough to other media that's out there that they become a genuine source for advertising revenue from agencies and from their clients.
Yeah. There were in the pre-war period a very small number. You start to see some African Americans working in the big agencies.
Correct.
But numbers are small. Then after the war, there's a big jump, but still the total numbers are small.
Yes.
At what point, and did in fact in big agencies, they start to think about the African-American market, and did they actually say, you know, we need to get a black guy. We need to get a black guy to come in here mm-hmm. to tell us how to sell to black people. Did that actually happen?
It's something that started to happen in the late 1940s, but it's the early 1950s, when an agency by the name of BBDO, they hire a gentleman by the name of Clarence Holt, whose responsibility it is to establish a Negro marketing department or a special markets department within the agency for their clients who are interested in reaching the Negro consumer market. But in terms of large numbers, relatively large numbers being hired, it's something that we don't really see until the mid to late 1960s. Mm-hmm. But in the 40s and 50s, we did see a few agencies stepping out there and hiring African Americans. You also had a number of them hire African American freelance professionals because there were many agency owners and leaders who had significant concerns about what will it mean, for example, to office morale if we change what has to this point been a racially homogenous environment and we inject an African American professional into this environment. What will that mean to us? What will that maybe mean to my office, to office politics and esprit de corps, if you will? And so many of them answered that question by saying, I'm not going to take that chance. Mm. And so that's something that David Sullivan, who we talked about earlier, that's something that David Sullivan faced.
Well, what sort of experience did these men, and I expect that they were men.
That's correct, too.
face in trying to work in these large white agencies?
The early ones, the interesting thing was that the early ones faced, let's just say, there were some challenges. Some of which were racially based, but many of the early ones were able to make a long career out of working in these agencies. Clarence Holt worked in the agency business for several decades. Roy Eaton worked in the business for several decades. George Olden worked in the business for several decades. Leonard Evans exited the advertising business on his own terms because he decided to start up a newspaper supplement. So many of the most visible ones had long careers in the agency business. The challenge that they faced, however, was similar to other African Americans in other industries, was potentially lower pay or the doors not necessarily being open if they wished to change jobs. So I might be a Clarence Holt might be fine at BBDO, but if he wished to raise his salary by moving to another agency, that option may be being closed. Or an agency agreeing to only hire one and not agreeing to hire more than one. So somebody like a David Sullivan, who had years of experience in the advertising agency business, after he closed his own agency, it took him, he worked for years to get a job in a mainstream firm. He talks about in his, some of his letters, he talks about talking to people at a mainstream firm and the gentleman, white gentleman, telling him, I know you can do the work. I know you have the experience. I know you should be making more money than you're making, but I can't take the chance and hire you. I don't know what that'll do to my relationship with my clients or with the rest of my employees. Hmm. And so Sullivan, by basis only of his race, lost opportunity or missed opportunity.
Yeah. And just as a point of interest, if you ask how were women doing in their participation in the industry? Mm-hmm. I'm sure not at the level of men, but you can say that the industry was much more willing to hire women because they recognized now there was a market.
That's right. That's right. Very, very early on in the agency business, we're talking about 1910s and early 19-teens. Very early on, the agency business recognized that 80% of purchases were 80+% of purchases were either done by or influenced by women. So J. Walter Thompson, which was the leading agency in the country and in the world for 6+ decades, they recognized this very early on, and they actually started a specific department led by, headed by, staffed by women to reach out to the female consumer market. Now, every agency didn't necessarily have a specific women's department like that, but let's just say at J. Walter Thompson, for a few years in the 1920s, the work that was being done by this women's editorial department was a large percentage of the billings that were even coming out of the agency entirely. So the agency world recognized very early on that women professionals may be something that they would like to have. Now, those opportunities were still limited. Their pay was still, in many cases, less than that of men. But relative to other industries, in terms of gender, the advertising agency business was relatively open. In terms of race, relatively closed.
Mm. We're about midway through this conversation again. Our guest for this hour, Focus 580, is Jason Chambers. He is assistant professor of advertising here at the University of Illinois and is the author of a book that takes a look at African Americans in the advertising industry. His book is Madison Avenue and the Color Line, and it's published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We talked about the fact that there was at least one person who was trying to advise advertisers on how to sell to the black market, you know, what to do and what not to do. Mm-hmm. And certainly that had to do with the kind of images that were presented in advertising. Mm-hmm. Basically, it was a list of stuff he was saying, don't do this.
Right.
One point I think that comes to very clearly is that for a lot of the people who became involved in the industry, and perhaps this was more true, say, from the 60s on, was that in addition to their interest in having a career and working in this business, they were, in fact, interested in trying to have a positive influence on the image of black people and black America in advertising.
That's right.
At what point do you think that became a strong motivation for people who were wanting to have a career in advertising?
I think that's something that was there from the very beginning, because even if we go back to the African-American newspaper leaders in the 19-teens and the 1920s and what they were telling and saying to advertisers and agencies, there was a combination of reaching out to this specific consumer market, but at the same time, changing the representations of African-Americans that were there. So in other words, if you wanted to sell to an African-American housewife, you couldn't use images of her children that showed them as dark or very, very dark in a negative way, or dirty or unkempt, those kinds of things. So the notion of the image and the representation being actually being connected to the ability to sell is something that was there early on. And from the standpoint of African American agency owners and leaders, so they're an heir to that tradition that had been there for 4 decades. And so their first and foremost job, they recognized, was to sell their clients' products. But within the sale of those products, it becomes, we can do that by using these positive representations at the same time.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that that you write about that happened in the 60s was that large civil rights organizations, groups like the NAACP and the Urban League, started to band together, in a sense, mobilize black consumers as a way of demonstrating their power and then using that power to have some sort of influence on images.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not just something that African-American groups did. Other minority groups did the same kind of things. And I guess the thing to me that comes to mind first was that the kind of pressure that Latinos brought to bear on Frito-Lay,
mm-hmm.
when we got rid of the Frito Bandito.
Right.
And I'm sure that there were other kinds of things as well that happened. Other groups said, you know, there's images here. We got a lot of problems with this, and we really want you to do something. So saying to the manufacturers and advertisers, you know, just get rid of this stuff. Are there some particular examples that you think that stand out of ways that that African American organizations said, "Look, we've got a lot of people behind us, we've got a lot of purchasing power behind us. Here are our concerns, and we want you, corporate America, to address these concerns."
Those kind of concerns, maybe not so much in terms of representations and images by the time we got to the 1960s, but with things like employment, certainly. So, for example, against the Pepsi Cola Company, when African Americans looked and said, "You don't have enough black white collar employees. There aren't enough African American managers. There aren't enough African American executives at your agency." But at the same time, you're selling a large number of products to us, to our consumer population. And so, saying what we'd like to see is we'd like to see more African Americans in those positions. And if you're not willing to do so, or if you're not willing to provide more racially integrated advertisements, for example, if you're not willing to do so, then we're going to selectively not purchase your products. And that's something that companies like Pepsi Cola, like Tasty Cake, which was a Philadelphia-based company, companies like that faced those challenges based upon their employment standards. Because what happened was African-American activists and consumers linked the representations or lack thereof in advertisements with a level of employment at a particular company. So it became, if we're not seeing ourselves in your advertisements, if you're not reaching out to us in your ads, then you probably also don't have us in your offices, in your companies, in your corporations. And so taking that step and saying, we're going to use our consumer power for employment changes. So the Frito Bandito was more of an image-based case. Mm-hmm. African-American activists by that time had transitioned over to linking their representations and advertisements to employment changes at the self-same time.
Yeah. Well, then how did advertising agencies respond? I mean, did they suddenly start thinking, well, now we've got to address this, but in order to address that, we've got to have more black employees. So do we now go out and get into a period where ad agencies are actually in a deliberate way trying to recruit black employees?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was a bubble, if you will, during the 1960s in which agencies were going out and trying to either actively find African-American advertising professionals, perhaps people who had been working as freelancers, or there was a spate of training programs that were run in the mid to late 1960s through the early 1970s, as some agencies and advertising organizations actually tried to develop, to give people who were trainable, educatable, give them the skills necessary to become advertising agency professionals, or at least employable. That was the story on the face of it. Didn't always necessarily happen like that in practice. You had many people who came through these training programs say, it was, you know, we had a wonderful experience in the training programs, but then when we actually got into the agencies and got into the offices, nobody spoke to us or nobody gave us anything to do. We became the title of a popular book at the time, we became the spook who sat by the door, right? We were there only to show how diverse an agency was, or specifically was not.
So some agencies, that they didn't know what to, they got these people and then they didn't know what to do with it.
That became the challenge, because what you might have would be the pressure from the top of an advertising agency, let's just say from the CEO or from a senior vice president, somebody who'd been participating in the conversations with civil rights organizations and activists and said, hey, we'll go ahead and we'll do these things to train and hire African-American professionals. that maybe didn't filter down into the organization, into the day-to-day life in which a person, a new employee, might experience. And so you, speaking to older African-American agency professionals who were there at this time, you know, they would say, well, I was sitting in my cubicle and I looked up and everybody on the team was headed down somewhere. And finally, you know, I snatched somebody who was on the team and said, well, where's everybody going? Oh, well, there's a meeting. Oh, nobody told me, nobody informed me, nobody asked me to come. And so many people who came through these training programs left the business for these reasons. Yeah.
We have a caller. We'd welcome others. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Someone here calling on a cell phone. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I really appreciate the discussion. It's really, really interesting. I wondered, and this is kind of tangential, but I wondered recently there was this, I think it was a car dealer who developed a commercial, and he delivered it in Spanish as well as in English. And there was a bit, I don't know how widespread that commercial was, but there was a big backlash. Many people were like very upset that he did this in Spanish, and he came on and said he was going to continue to do it in Spanish or offer commercials in Spanish as well. And I wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
Certainly. Well, I think in a case like that, it's a business owner who's saying, I'm going to deliver to the consumers that I have. And in this day and age, with the growing Hispanic and Latino population that we have in this country, many of whom, for whom Spanish is their first language and they're learning, and English is their second, rather, I should say, I certainly think that delivering a commercial in both languages to reach consumers that you recognize that you have, or recognize that you at least desire to have, I think that's an effective marketing tool. And I think that we actually may see a bit more of that in the mainstream press or on mainstream television and radio programs.
Yeah, I agree, and I thought it was real smart on his part. I was surprised at the backlash, and so many people upset that he would do that. Is there anything akin to that in the African American in your study of the history of African American representation? I mean, was there a backlash for companies that were trying to market to the African-American community? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. That's actually an excellent question. And in most cases, or in many cases, I should say, no, there was no backlash, that white consumers and other groups of consumers did not care that a company was reaching out to the African-American consumer market or other diverse kinds of markets. We did see a minimal backlash with a case in the early 1960s. There was a group called Monitor South, and what it was a group of people, white Southerners, who didn't like the image of the Southern representations that they were seeing in the media and the mainstream press and the like, that all Southerners, and this is came out in some of their literature, that they all Southerners were backward or didn't know how to speak and those kinds of things, but usually not to a company's inclusion of African or reaching out to the African-American consumer market. The one backlash that I did see based on race dealt with the Pepsi Cola company when they hired their first African American vice president, and his wife was very fair skinned. She was very light skinned. And so there was a group of white Southerners who wanted to boycott the Pepsi company because they thought that they had hired an African American gentleman who was married to a white woman. And so there was a brief boycott of Pepsi Cola products for that reason, but it was not very widespread. But what we find is that companies were wrong. Reaching out to an African-American or Latino or Asian consumer market didn't impact the way that white consumers actually bought their product.
And that was just to go back to an earlier point, and we talked about this a little earlier, the fact it was that there was a point where companies were worried about that. They were worried if they made a deliberate and obvious attempt to reach out to African-Americans, that the white Americans would somehow be offended, and then they wouldn't want to buy that product. And it turns out that apparently, at least at the point where we're talking about here, so it would have been, say, in the 60s or mm-hmm. later, it turns out nobody cared.
The
consumers didn't care.
That's right. If a person liked your product, if a person bought your product, they could largely care less who else was buying your product or who else you were reaching out to attract yourself to those products. And so the caller's question or the caller's story about the backlash against the dual language commercial spot, that's a little curious, but it would be interesting to see if that actually transitions over from a vocal displeasure to an actual avoidance of that company's products.
Yeah. Well, has someone, I would assume someone has done work along this line. If you have a commercial and say your spokesperson is African American,
mm-hmm.
and he is the person that is essentially selling the product,
mm-hmm.
Someone has looked at how it is that, say, people who are not black look at that person and ask this question, well, can you relate to that person? Does the fact that he is black and you're white somehow interfere with your getting the message or thinking about that product? I mean, does the fact that the spokesperson is black, does that say to you, well, somehow that's a black product, and as a white person, I'm, you know, that product is not for me? There must be people who have actually looked at that, and does that in fact have influence on how people receive the message and their willingness to buy the product?
Absolutely. That's one of the things that scholars and academics studied very, very heavily in the early 1970s. Many, many studies being published at that time. If we change the African-American character in the ad, if we include one at all, or if we put him or her in a leadership position, if he or she is speaking from a position of authority to a white person, how does that impact how the product is received or the advertisement is received by white consumers? So many studies were done like that in the early 1970s. There is in our own time, there is an excellent scholar at The Ohio State University by the name of Asay Appiah. He studies those things today. And what study after study after study, both in the 1970s and up to our own time, have shown is, A, it doesn't impact the way that white consumers see the product at all. They will, if they're already buying it, they'll continue to buy it. If they have an interest in buying it, they'll still look at the product, regardless of the fact that it has an African-American in the ad or in a leadership position in the ad. And Asay Appiah has actually found that the ad becomes more attractive. It draws more interest amongst white consumers if there's an African-American character in the ad. And so what he's found is that you get the benefit of A, reaching out to African-American consumers if blacks are in the ad and in leadership positions and the like, and B, you also get greater interest and attention from white consumers if an African-American is in the ad. So you would think, at least from what the research has shown, is there's a double benefit from having African-Americans in these ads.
So it's also the case that you may well have a better effect if you have an African-American in the ad. You may well also have a better effect among African-Americans.
Absolutely.
But also among white Americans.
And that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And this is something that we're finding that he found in his studies in 2005, 6, 7, 8, changing multiple things about how the character is shown or how the character is portrayed. And he still finds a great degree of effectiveness through this technique.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Jason Chambers. Again, he is a professor of advertising here at the University of Illinois, also an advertising consultant. He is author of the book Madison Avenue and the Color Line. It's about the participation of African Americans in the advertising industry, and it is published by University of Pennsylvania Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. As we have talked in the 60s for a variety of reasons, this was the point at which now we start to see significant numbers of African Americans going into the business,
mm-hmm.
In part because advertisers and people who make and sell products were finally clued to the idea that this was a very significant market. Partly because of organized pressure, partly because of the fact that government, state and local governments were insisting that barriers to employment for African Americans start to be dealt with. So
mm-hmm.
here there's a period of time where, say, particularly between, say, the mid-60s and the mid-70s, this is the time in which you say this is the golden age.
Mm-hmm.
What was happening at that time, and then what happened to take us into the whatever you want to call the era after the golden age, where we are now?
Primarily, I would point to two things. First and foremost, I'd certainly point to the recession that hits in the early to mid 1970s. It became difficult for anybody to justify maintaining a training program to develop new employees when we're laying off experienced professionals, when we're laying off experienced people. So why should I create somebody with a month and a half worth of training experience when I'm laying off somebody with 6 years worth of experience. So certainly the loss of training programs in the early 1970s due to the economic recession certainly was a heavy impact. But I would also point to the fact that attention to the issue became simply waned. It became much less public. The primary organization that had been putting a lot of pressure and attention on the advertising industry, the New York City Commission on Human Rights, their attention drifted to other issues. The makeup of the commission changed. And so the attention to the issue, the publication of statistics, the publication of articles in Advertising Age, once the recession was over, those things didn't return. And so the attention to the matter, the attention to the issue went off the table. And so, therefore, what we found is that approximately every 12 to 15 years, give or take, since that point, the question of diversity in advertising comes up again, and getting more minority professionals and maintaining more minority professionals in advertising comes up again. We saw it most recently just a few years ago in 2006 when the City Commission on Human Rights brought the issue up again of employment of African-American and other minority professionals in agencies. And so every 12 to 15 years, we see the issue come up again for various reasons. So we'll see. We're in that period right now. We'll see what actual changes actually take place.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that within the advertising world that there is now a much more finely tuned appreciation for all the various niches that there are that you got to market to in terms of people's ethnicity, in terms of their age, in terms of gender, and I'm sure that the advertising agency still recognizes the fact that women drive an awful lot of purchases. It's still the case, as it always has been. But that there are a number of various kinds of categories of people that I'm sure that they're looking at, particularly when it comes to particular kinds of products. Mm-hmm. So they know that they've got to be able to tailor the message to fit a diverse kind of population.
Right.
But you know, is it the case, though, that they don't feel that they have to have people working in their agencies that are those kinds of people that they figure, well, we can figure it out. We don't have to have actual representatives of these people in our agency to tell us how to sell to them. We're smart enough to figure out how to sell to them ourselves.
Certainly. It becomes a very dangerous thing to say that in order to sell to African Americans, you have to be African American, or in order to sell to the gray population or the senior population, you have to be gray or you have to be a senior. It's a very dangerous thing to say that. The thing is that it becomes, how much attention do you pay to the nuances within that population, to the nuances within that culture, within that portion or segment of society? How much attention do you pay to that, such that your advertising is received by members of that population to be authentic, or received by members of that population to be something that knows and recognizes the differing aspects of that population from other forms of other versions of your advertisement. Mm-hmm. And so it's a matter of having that particular knowledge that makes one or a good advertiser or not, or a good advertising agency or not.
Well, we talked about the fact that certainly for a long time there were people within the African American community that were very sensitive to and concerned about the images of African Americans that appeared in advertising and felt that they wanted to do something about that. And certainly there were people then who went into the business who, in addition to wanting to have that for a career, were thinking about the fact that put them in a position perhaps to do something about that. And perhaps that was something that was always there, but that perhaps was even more that was even more of an issue or more of a concern. It was on people's minds, particularly when you get into the 60s and later. This idea that, you know, we're, in addition to doing what we're doing here, we're selling, we also are in a position to have an influence on images, and that's an important and significant kind of power to have. So having said that, then, do you think that there are concrete ways in which advertising has changed perceptions of who African Americans are and what the African American community is like, and that has helped to create in the minds of all Americans a different kind of image, and that advertising has, in a deliberate way, advertising has actually done that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If we think about it, in terms of how much advertising we see upwards of, studies vary, and numbers vary, but upwards of 2,500 to 3,000 advertising representations a day. If we watch a 30-minute television program, approximately 10 minutes of that program is made up of advertising. So one-third of what we spend that half hour watching is advertisements, is made up of or by an advertising agency, somebody not necessarily directly connected to the content of the program. And so advertising is such a huge source of information, even if it's something that people say, I don't recognize or I don't pay attention to, those kinds of things. Advertising is such a huge source of information. So many representations and so many descriptions, depictions, pictures, words about who we are as a nation, who we are as a society. Advertising is and must be something that communicates, and it has been something that communicates the position of African Americans in the community, in the society. It communicates who has power, who doesn't have power, who's important, who's not important, who's in leadership, what positions somebody plays. And by showing something, and this is something that activists in the 1960s recognized and pushed the agency business on, by showing African Americans in these positions in your ads, what would seem to be a very simplistic thing, it's something that can help ease that transition when somebody actually sees it in their own life. So if you see an African-American, let's just say, manager in an office setting in an advertisement, if you actually enter that office setting in your own life and you see an African-American there, it becomes almost commonplace. Because, again, we have to recognize the social power of advertising in addition to its economic power.
Mm-hmm. So what was it that got you interested in writing it on the subject in the first place? Because I don't think that you started out specifically being interested in looking at the advertising business, did you?
No, I didn't. I started out to be an African-American historian, but it was a book that came out shortly after my near the end, I should say, of my graduate career, called the History of Black Business in America, in which the author looked at all of the various ways and places in which African Americans had participated in business over the decades and the centuries, places and areas that hadn't been recognized until the publication of her book. And so this, when I looked at advertising literature, it was in terms of the historical descriptions and depictions, it was something in which African Americans weren't present. And so I knew the long history that African Americans had in the media trade, in the newspaper trade. And I said, well, if they've been in that trade for that long and they've been interested in publishing papers for that long, then they wouldn't have overlooked the advertising industry. And so I simply said, well, let me go back and let me look and see what their participation has been. And I was actually very much surprised about how long they had participated in the business and how early on they had actually tried to get into the business and how persistent they had been in trying to get into the business.
Yeah. Are there now significant African-American ad agencies, or is it more? So there are indeed important black-owned agencies now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The top, there are several in the country, the top four being Global Hue, Carol H. Williams Advertising, Burrell Communications in Chicago, and Uniworld Agency. The top four, they have 60% of the employees that African-American employees in the business, and they also really dominate the revenue of the African-American agency trade. Those four agencies, their combined revenue together is double that of the next six agencies of the top 10. Mm-hmm. So there are still significant agencies, and there's still significant African-American professionals that are out there like others putting out excellent and wonderful work, working in mainstream firms as well as African-American-owned firms.
Yeah. And just now, having had the opportunity to think about this and look at a lot of examples of advertising over time, is there anything that you just now, though, see today? Now in 2008, you just shake your head and think, how is that possible now? How is it that somebody did that and didn't really think about the implications now at this late date?
It's been some time since I've seen an advertisement like that. Today, I simply think about the use of humor and the way that humor is used in advertising, maybe a little bit more so than race. I have to admit, and this is one of the advances that I've seen over the last couple of years in the advertising trade, it's been a while since we've had a real obvious kind of gaffe, if you will, in terms of the way that a member of a racial group is actually used.
Mm-hmm. Well, at this point, I think that we're going to have to finish up. It is a very interesting book, and if people would like to read more about this, you take a look at the book that we've talked about. The title is Madison Avenue and the Color Line, African Americans in the Advertising Industry. It's published by the University of Pennsylvania Press by our guest, Jason Chambers. He's an advertising consultant. He is also assistant professor of advertising at the University of Illinois. Well, thank you very much.
David, thank you for having me.
We appreciate it.